Gillette on CBS FM, the free FM. PennRadio@gmail.com, PennRadio.com. I'm going to give the phone number, 866-570-PEN, but I don't think we're going to take a phone call because this is Michael Goodall and I are going to take the day off and just let Dennis Miller do the whole show. Dennis Miller is here. We were first on that horrible year of Saturday Night Live. We were the guests that only did a few shows. Were you Weekend Update the very first year?
Yeah, that's I was witness to the accident. You know, but you look back on that cast, Penn, and it's pretty amazing. It might not have been in their cup of tea, sketch comedy, but Joan Cusack was on there, and Downey, you know, I mean, Bob Downey, Anthony Michael Hall, Randy Quaid. I mean, we had some interesting people. They just were not, it was not Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows.
But you were brought in directly to do the Weekend Update.
Yeah, I had auditioned for it and didn't get it. And I saw the cast announced in USA Today, and John Lovitz was to do the news originally. But he was so needed in so many things that they literally couldn't have him do the news, too. And so around 2 weeks out from the first show, Lorne called me. I was on the David Letterman show. They said, Lorne Michaels wants to see you upstairs, which comes completely from left field. And you go in, and you know Lorne, he's pretty cut and dry. He says, you want to do the news? I said, yeah. He said, I'll see you tomorrow. And you walk out, and you think, God, and you always wonder what the moment's like when your life changes, and it just happened, and it was pretty innocuous. You know what I mean? I was over the moon, but there was no... you know, no trumpets going off or anything.
Have you always wanted to be political?
No. You know, when I didn't do topical humor till I got that job. A couple things here and there, but listen, you know what it's like to be unknown on the road. I mean, to get Saturday Night Live, they could have told me they wanted me just to warm the crowd up. I would have been there. But to get Weekend Update, I remember thinking the one savvy thing I remember choosing to do on Saturday Night Live was I wasn't a very skilled actor or sketch comic, and I'm pathologically afraid of improvisation. So I remember thinking you should be like the DH in the American League. Just stay out of the way. Try to open with a nice rock and roll riff each week, knock off 10 minutes, and get out of the way. Because if you're the fourth lead in these sketches, the bartender, you got to be there blocking 8 hours a day, and you don't get any payoff. So that was a pretty good move, I think. Giving them me in little drips and drabs, I think, worked.
And how many years did you do it?
Six.
6 years. Mm-hmm. And I want to say, I don't want to forget, you're at the MGM now for those people in Vegas or over the weekend. Then you'll be in Atlantic City next week for people in New York and Caesars. And a lot of people, when you say Dennis Miller's going to be on, want to talk about you being in a world that is entirely liberal. You tend to be a conservative and a supporter of Bush and so on. And I'm being libertarian. That puts me
as
outsiders.
I mean, I'm for gay marriage. I don't believe in abortion, but I'm pro-choice because it's none of my business. Pretty much anything goes with me if you're not, infringing your stuff on other people. But I'll tell you, 9/11 changed me. I don't know what to say. I mean, you got to go around and explain it to people. They think you're a turncoat, but the simple fact is I think we have to go seek these guys out wherever they are. And by these guys, I mean, you know, terrorist. And I know people are going to say, well, that wasn't Iraq. But listen, Iraq, he's a bad guy. I'm glad he's out of there. I try to think of what it would be like if he was still in there. It doesn't sound like a good scenario to me.
How do you feel about the torture stuff that's all going on now?
Listen, waterboarding sounds good to me. I think you guys used to do that in your act, if I'm not mistaken.
Certainly.
I think you took that to Broadway.
What amazes me, I can understand the physical torture, but I don't understand having any limits on humiliation whatsoever.
Well, I don't know much about breaking people down, but I'm sure my first introduction to it was the original Manchurian Candidate, which was such a brilliant depiction of that. But I guess after a while, you just want to get information from these people. You want to beat them down in some way. Now, I'm not for the rack or anything like that, but if they really can't kill anybody when they're waterboarding him, and already I've heard a guy named Ross, I saw him on Fox the other night, he's a pretty good correspondent for one of the big networks, and he was saying that his sources tell him they've waterboarded around 14 people, and they feel that they uncovered a plot to blow up a tower, I guess that big one downtown in Los Angeles. And you know, listen, I look at the terrorists and I just think, You know, you cannot play by the Marcus de Queensberry rules with these people. They're not going to do it. And you know what? If you try to be friendly with them, guess what? The UN tried to be friendly. They got blown. Their headquarters got blown up. I mean, they take, not New York, but they take advantage of people's trying to be friends with them, and I don't think we can afford that anymore. Now, I guess that, to me, that seems like the same pragmatism I've always brought to my politics, but some people don't think it is.
Now, when you made that kind of change, and I mean, I would get, you know, it was enough of a thing when you signed up, kind of said, I'm going to support the president, an unheard of thing in Hollywood, that people were calling me, who, you know, I hadn't hung out with you since Saturday Night Live and, you know, whenever that was, the late 80s, and they would call me up and go, what's up with Dennis? What's up? What was the feeling around from other people when you changed over there?
Well, some people were really cranky, but you know, when I'm 52 years old, I can't shoot my life through the prism. Am I at Rob Reiner's house? You know what I mean? I've always been honest. I had a show on TV. I had to talk about things. I thought about the troops, and you know, I met with some of the troops, and you know, the troops don't like it when you say you believe in the you believe in them, but you don't believe in their commander in chief or the cause. You know, they don't appreciate that. And I'll be honest with you, Penn. I my feelings are accurate. They reflect what I feel. But if I didn't believe in this war, I would just shut up for their sake. I really would. You got 20-year-old kids over there and some, you know, litter box overseas protecting our way of life. I would just zip it till they got home. But I just remember thinking, I want to be their advocate. I don't want to be another person who hedges their bets with them.
Well, we're the same age, so we went through. We were kids when Vietnam was happening, and right on the border of being sent over there. What were your feelings on Vietnam when that was happening?
I would say this: I find radical Islam shakier than those people. I'll just be honest. Every time I see somebody in the radical Islam movement, they're pointing their finger. They're jabbing their finger. It's almost like I don't even have to have the sound up. I watch and they're all cranky. And now with the advent of you know, the proliferation of post-Soviet Union nuclear material, I think somebody could put a dirty bomb together. And I'm just thinking that we got a heads up with 9/11. We should take the battle to them. Our heads up shouldn't be the next time it happens and somebody sets off a suitcase bomb in the New York subways. And I believe that's what would happen someday. Now, some people think I'm G. Gordon Liddy all of a sudden. But I just look at them and I think, okay, are we ever going to be friends with them? And I go, no, they're always PO. Now they got the Pope, fourth time today. Poor Pope's begging. At some point, the only thing he can do is become a mullah or a mullah. You know, he just has to take the mitre off and say, okay, I'm with you. I'm no longer the Pope.
But that is the answer. I mean, in the Quran, it says if you do not convert to Islam, you're out of it. You're down. They kill you.
Well, how much more of a heads up do we need?
Exactly.
I mean, that is a Macy's balloon sized tea leaf there, and I'm going to glean it.
And how much when you do your acts around here? I have not seen you live.
Not much.
Since
listen, I don't want to be up there doing the Sturm and Drang. I mean, I want to be funny. There's around 10-15 minutes in there, maybe out of an hour or an hour and 10 minutes, where you talk about current events and it comes up. But listen, I'm not Curtis LeMay now. I'm a comedian. They asked me one night on a talk show, what do you think? I said, I'm behind the president. And, the whole thing shifted. Now, I can tell you this. I've been on the left making fun of the right, and I've been, I guess I'm presumed now to be on the right making fun of the left. The left is a lot more cranky about taking their medicine. I've found that. You get some, you know, pissed off liberals at you. You know, people on the right, when I used to make fun of them, I'd bump into them periodically and they'd give you that, oh, you're mean to me. And then they'd start laughing. And it's almost like they knew that they were taking their butt whooping and they would smile and laugh about it. But people on the left get cranky, man.
Well, that's really, we also saw that in the election. I mean, the amount of hate that came out. I mean, I remember being at a local fair here in Vegas and I went over to the Kerry booth. Mm-hmm. Where they were supporting Kerry and handing out literature, and I asked one very simple question, which is, could you say something good about Kerry without saying anything bad about Bush? And his answer to that was, but Bush has done so much to ruin this country. And I think that the whole problem that campaign had, because Bush was not flying high then. I mean, he should have been able to be someone else coming in, is that their whole thing was based on hate. It was amazing. It was just anybody but.
You want to know my feeling? If Gore had gotten in and if Kerry had gotten in and that happened, I think they would have done something very similar to it. It's easy to sit out here and say, no, we would have never went to Iraq. I don't think they know that. I think there's a big binder they show you the first day you're president, and only you and a couple other guys get to see it. Not Gore, not Kerry. I think they open it up and go, okay, here's the real deal, what's happening. And I think both of those guys, and guess what? If they were my president right now, I'd be behind them, too. I didn't vote for them, but I would be behind them, and I would zip it as far as putting them down in front of our enemies, because I think we have flat-out enemies. I mean, you know, for God's sakes, people, you know, at least Khrushchev said he would bury us. There was a civility about it. These guys want to hang us up in a train station like Il Duce and let the, you know, let the birds eat our eyes out. It's a rough game right now.
Now, you have in the past, though, this has not always been your position that standing behind the president. You have made jokes against the president.
No, and I started on Fox last night as their essayist, and I poked some fun at Bush. I don't understand Bush with illegal immigration. I don't know what he's thinking there. I mean, for God's sakes, you know, I think it's reflexive guilt that Bush feels about his patrician upbringing that allows him to welcome anybody across our borders, because, you know, I think he made the long mosey from Yale to y'all, and along the way he met a lot of people that he construes them as authentics, and they don't take the American gift for granted. I think he likes that, so he opens the floodgates. I think that's wrong. I mean, I anybody can come here. I don't have anything against Mexican people, but for God's sake, sign the guest book on the way in. I mean, if you're going to knock off a nooner at a bad motel with a coworker, you have to scrawl your Juan Hancock on the desk blotter. Of course you should sign it when you come to the border. So I don't understand Bush on a lot of things. I don't get the gay marriage thing. If two people want to get hitched and they have similar genitalia, in the crazy world we live, I cannot tell you how far down my list of peeves that is. I got around 800 other things I got to think about each day. Well, they both have penises. They'd like to get hitched. Fine. I don't have time for that right now. So I don't understand Bush on certain things, but I'll tell you this. I like the fact that the guy doesn't care about his approval rating. It takes a first guesser to have second guessers, and he is the quintessential. We're all guessing. I don't think this plays out for another 100 years. I think it's East versus West in many ways now. And I don't think Bush is going to be rewarded in his lifetime. And I like how dogged he is. I think he gets up every morning and they say, listen, your approval rating is at 29%. And I think Bush is thinking, it could go to zero. I'm going to do what I think's right. And I think that scares the terrorists at some point. And I know Cheney scares them, because, you know, they're sitting there in those caves watching ESPN or CNN saying, Khalid, get over here. Cheney just shot his best friend in the head. Really? Why'd he do that? There was some bird he wanted to get to. The guy was in between him and the bird. He dropped him. 86 years old. Blast right to the skull. And he likes him. What's he going to do to us? He hates us. Let's pack up the tents, boys. We're sleeping in shifts. So I want the image we put out to the world now to be... I like it when Bush says if he bumps into Akhwavel Vajad in the UN, he's not going to talk to him, or whatever the hell that guy's name is. Little Corporal Klinger guy down there tearing us a new one. What's the deal? We got Hugo Chavez, Big Reds up in Harlem, giving us one from up there. Let's get rid of the UN. Turn it over to Trump for the next apprentice. I'm sick of it.
And did all this... And all this stuff with the border stuff, you think you want immigration to be easier, but just sign the guest book? Is that your position?
I just want to know who's here. Yeah. I mean, I want them to know if I'm here. I should have some. That sounds normal to me. What's the sense of having a country if you don't have any borders? We got better security at borders bookstores than we do at our actual borders. I go in and look at a copy of Maxim. I'm on Current Affair that night. I got 8 cameras trying. Ramzi El Kaboom can flit across the border wearing a bomber on his chest like Bob Guccione in a Krugerrand. Nobody says a word to him. What are we thinking?
Now, how much of the part of that is the religion that bothers you? You know, because I am an atheist.
Yeah.
And
I'm not a Christian, but I'll tell you what. I don't know. In a crazy world, I sometimes look enviously at Christians. I'm not a Christian. I believe in God. I don't quite know what that is, though. It's very ethereal for me. Mm-hmm. But I look at some of these people, and I just think they're scared witless. And they like the comforting feeling that they have either a patriarch or a matriarchal figure in their head. And I don't hold it against people. Once again, that might be behind gay marriage on my list. If somebody says, well, they believe in God. I don't even know that.
Where do you draw the line when the pious decide that their belief in God tells them to fly airplanes into buildings?
Well, hopefully right before the building. That's where you draw the line. I'm getting to the point now where I don't trust religions where you can get winded praying. I like a little less fervency, I like a little more you have to coexist with other human beings. That's what I'm looking for in a God, I don't know how you deal with that. I think we're going to find out, but I think it's going to be a slow unfolding process over the next 50 to 100 years. All I know is you cannot keep threatening like the Pope's life, and I think this will eventually tip on them where people will go, wait a second, you're constantly PO'd. Settle down, for God's sakes.
But that's the part that's so odd about the liberals kind of, in ways, taking the side of the Muslims, saying that the attacks are racist and so on, whereas everything the liberals seem to carry on about, women's rights and peace and all that stuff, those Muslim countries are the worst at. I was in Egypt for 2 weeks and couldn't take the women being dressed like Batman and all that, all that weird.
They
kind
always
of stuff.
Look like Atticus's daughter Scout when she went out as a baked ham for Halloween and kill a mockingbird.
they just do that. They do that whole thing there.
I don't know what's up with. Listen, I've been a liberal in my life. I'm liberal on a few things. I cannot hate as much as some of them do right now, though. And like I said, if Hillary gets in next time, guess what? I'm not going to hate her either. I'm too old to be hating people, for God's sakes. I want to relax during the day. When Clinton was the president, I had problems with Clinton. Probably about simplistic things. I've had interns work for me, and I don't go near interns. You shouldn't. It's just bad form in the workplace, for God's sakes. Monica Lewinsky was the president. 42 of those guys. You should do it for the scrapbook.
Well, exactly. I want to step further on that. What a great story that would be.
I'm not even gay. Had I worked there and he asked me, I might have knocked it off. Just to have something to tell the kids about on the really, Dad? Yeah, I was a bit of a patriot.
We're going to be back with Dennis Miller after this. This is Penn Jillette sitting with Michael Godeau, who's saying nothing. That's the way we like it. We'll be back with Dennis Miller right after this. This is Penn Jillette sitting with Michael Godeau in Las Vegas. And we're talking to Dennis Miller. When you talk to Dennis Miller, that's all you got to do.
I miss your tones, Ben. When we used to run in New York a little, I always thought I was with the world's hippest carnival barker. And just to hear your voice again up close is good.
Oh, that's good. Yeah,
huh? Stentorian. Used to kill me when you did Broadway and used to say, don't smoke, kids. Unless you want to look really cool.
Yeah.
I used to think... That is the most un-PC sentiment I've ever heard in my life.
Well, it was the idea, Well, with a voice like this, you've got to do a lot of damage in a lot
exactly.
of different ways.
You got to do this or sell Vegematics on the boardwalk, my
That was
friend.
Always my goal. That was always my goal. When I had aspirations to actually be successful in show business. you had that plan.
Yes, I had a dream.
My plan was to sell waterless cookware. At fairs. That was what I thought. From my little town, I thought, well, that's as close as I'm going to get to show business. And that's all I intended to do. I was just at the Minnesota State Fair, and I just sat there watching those guys, and I said to my wife, this far from this being our life, you could have been in a trailer
exactly.
preparing the carrots for me to cut them up. Because that's what I'm, that's what I'm set to do. Some people are born to it. I was really born to be a Vegematic salesman.
I know. I always hear those stories about people who knew they were in showbiz early on where they were doing, production numbers from Hell's a Poppin' in front of their parents and Thanksgiving down in the rec room. I never had that either. I woke up one day and said, I need a job back or I'm going to end up selling double pane windows over the phone to people who don't need them. So that's why I got it.
And you just went right into stand-up?
Yeah, I was lucky enough. I was walking by a bar in Pittsburgh, it said stand-up comedy tonight. And this was way back when, before it all exploded. And I thought, wow, I can't believe somebody does that for a living. And I went in. I said, I have to go see that. So I went in and saw the guy that night. And he was, thankfully, he was so bad. And I mean atrocious, a train wreck. I remember thinking, I can be that bad, for God's sakes. Let me step up. And I did it. And I was a little better than him. It was enough to set the hook. And then, you know, the rest of it, you just pound it out over the years.
So from the time you you first took a microphone and did stand-up to Saturday Night Live update was how long?
I'd say it was around 3 years or 4 years.
That's
or
pretty
something.
Fast.
Yeah, I was lucky in that they had an audition in L.A., and I went. And, you know, the Saturday Night Live, it was beautiful because they would... They wouldn't coax you. You didn't have to be on that show if you wanted. You better think on your feet. You better be tough-minded. It taught me how to be tough. I remember the audition took us to New York then, and we got up in front of a studio of people in Times Square, and Lauren said, you have 10 minutes. Do whatever you want. And, you know, at the moment, you can see that what the task is to not go belly up and gag. It doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be seamless. You know, it's not like everybody's going in there. You don't know what the process is. He just says, you got 10. Go ahead. And the key is that moment, not just going, it's just bolting right into it. And I remember I just bammed into it. And so SNL taught me that whenever I have a kid, I don't know about you, when kids come up to you on the road and they say, how do I make it? I almost want to say to them, you're dead in the water right now. Because I always look at that one kid who's in the back of the room and he's giving you that look. He's never going to ask you a question. He's just going to kill you eventually. You know, that look like, well, your job's mine, so you better get on with it, old man. That's the kid who makes it.
Yeah. Well, Lauren also does such weird manipulative stuff. You know, we did the upside down bit on Saturday Night Live, and we did it during rehearsal, and then we did it that night during the show, and it went very, very well. And Lauren came up to us afterwards and said the strangest thing. He said, you know, I guess that was an okay call. You know, the dress rehearsal went very well, and I loved the bit and thought it was one of the best things you guys would ever do. And he said, I thought about taking you aside and saying, this really sucks. We're in trouble. I'm probably going to have to cut it just to jack it up to another level. And I chose not to when it was probably the right call.
Yeah, well, Lauren has a beautiful sense of salon, man. He's like Gertrude Stein. He assembles, you know, funny, quick, neurotic people. And he, you know, it's like there used to be a comedian named Mike Dugan who did a great show. He said he knows how to hit your buttons because he installed them. And he knows exactly where they're at. And that's a good play for what he did with you on that. Because I remember Michael Douglas told me once when he was doing Wall Street after the first couple days, Oliver, who I think is probably a bit of a manipulator too, grabbed Michael. He said, you don't have this, do you? Michael said, what? I thought I was kicking it out of the park. And he goes, man, I'm surprised. I thought you'd have this. You don't have this. Michael said he came in the next day and started pounding it, cut to him standing there with the Oscar. So these guys know what they're doing.
I guess
Svengalis know what they're doing.
Yeah, that's how they
that's
get
that's why they're Svengalis.
Exactly. Now, so you said you're how many weeks a year do you work now? How much you doing touring stuff?
Not much, Ben. Well, you know, this summer I got fired from CNBC, and I remember thinking my immediate play is usually panic. How do I get the next thing? Am I going to fall off the face of the planet? Do I lack gravity as a human being if I don't work? And I remember thinking, you know, you're 52 now. You got to figure out some other plan here. You got to enjoy some things. So this summer I did three things. I went to the Himalayas for 10 days, a little kingdom called Bhutan, hiked up in the mountains. My friend Tom Hanks and I rented a tour bus and took our kids to six different ballparks and six different nights on the East Coast to see six different ball games. And then I got home from that and I went to Africa for 2 weeks and went on safari. And you know what? I must tell you, when people say, what are you doing now? I go, I'm having a time of my life, and it's not about work. I wanted to try some things.
What did you do on safari?
Because well,
you
know,
you want to ask questions about this.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Who booked that?
Well, F.M. Allen, actually.
All right, I got it.
Very nice woman named Marcia Gordon. And it's
how long were you there?
2 weeks.
Oh, that's a long time.
Listen,
and you weren't online?
Well, the last place I went to, which was out in the Serengeti Plain, you get in this tent, and the guy comes in. We're staying in this tented cabin. He said, by the way, you got wireless here. I'm looking around. I'm watching wildebeests feed on Dead Carcass thingy, man, it has gone everywhere now that I literally am in a tent out near the Pillars of Hercules, and we have wireless. Unbelievable.
Now, how many people were on this so far?
I took my wife and my two sons. And, you know, at the end of it, the boys, quite frankly, we could have probably made it 2-3 days less, because it's a bad thing to get jaded when you're out in Africa, because then you realize how you always have to turn over the excitement level in your head. Literally, after 2 weeks, the guy would say, there is an elephant. You know, it's like 4 feet away, and you're thinking, okay, great, elephant. Can I get home? You don't want to be nonplussed about the pachyderm. That's a little too jaded.
And what did you do? What did you do in the Himalayas, for Christ's sake?
You know, I just hiked around, and you know, there's this place called the Tiger's Lair there. It's in Bhutan. It's built into a rock face, like one of those old Hopi Indian places you always see. And it's around 10,000 feet. You start hiking at 7,000 feet. You get up there. It's really a circuitous hike. And at that altitude, it's pretty brutal. And then you get up there, and it's the coolest thing. It's like Eddie Murphy's The Golden Child or something. They've got these six young monks in waiting, and they're like ages 12, 10, 8, 6. And then they have the big monk, the main man, like Kung Fu Monk, and he's teaching them. And that's about all that lives up there. They don't live with their families anymore. They've been taken away from their families, and not taken away, given away. I mean, it's a great thing for the parents to do. And I'm sitting there looking at this six-year-old kid, and I'm thinking, what the heck kind of life is this for a six-year-old? This has got to be weird. I don't care how holy it is. It's got to be a weird gig. I look over at the kid. We're in this very sanctimonious chamber. The guy's blessing us and all this. And I'm just taking a gander around the room. The little six-year-old looks up at me, and he smiles this big smile, and he's got a pair of wax vampire teeth in. And I remember thinking, you can't take the kid. You can take him to the end of the world. He's still going to be a kid. It was the most beautiful part of the trip for me. Gave it his big look with the teeth and then hid them. Like,
Where did he get them?
Somebody must have snuck him in. Maybe one of his brothers. I hear they go home once every few months to stay with their family for a day or two, so they stay in touch. But somebody snuck him to him, and here he was being a kid. It brought me great joy.
How are these kids chosen? Do you know?
No, I don't. Listen, I don't know the drill.
You didn't become an expert on the...
They were the slowest runners.
The monks know how to capture kids.
It's a very hallowed privilege over there,
yeah.
But you're right.
The slowest runner.
But it was
God
cool.
Has granted you the gift of not running.
And so you were there for 2 weeks too, right?
Nah, 10 days. Just went around 4 or 5 different stops. It's a great joint, Bhutan. And I just wanted to see some other things, for God's sakes. Like, I don't know about you, I started young on the road. You told me you were out there for 30 years.
Yeah, on the road,
it's like
years.
We know there's a mini Statue of Liberty somewhere down in... you know, Alabama or something, and some small Birmingham, Alabama, right, has a mini Statue of Liberty. But then somebody says, do you ever seen anything neat? And you go, nope, always been on the road.
I was much, much, much worse than that. Teller, you know, when we would be touring, he would, you know, I would do morning radio, and then there'd be sound check at 4. And in between, you know, Teller, who didn't do morning radio, he had to sleep some, mm-hmm, he would go around and, like, sightsee a little bit. He'd go to, like, museums and stuff. I never left the hotel room. I could not tell what city I was in. I never had any
You were
idea.
In the bubble.
Absolutely.
Full
in the
bore
bubble.
In the bubble.
We played a place in Pennsylvania, some college town, and the hotel had entirely, it was round, so that all the rooms were completely curved and round.
I think I've been
in
that. Penn State University Park?
Like that, yeah.
Maybe.
And so we came down the next day and got in the van with the crew, and they were saying, wow, what about these round rooms, huh? And I said, what? They said, you were in a round room last night. And I went, oh, I just went to bed and read. And they said, have you ever opened your curtain in your room? And I go, no, no. I don't really look out.
No, you made Elvis look like a gadfly. You were beyond tinfoil. You
Absolutely.
Were doing sheet metal.
Absolutely. No, no idea where I was at all.
I remember Johnny Dark used to do that great joke where he said, the road's all the same to me. I remember I was somewhere near Baltimore. I clipped my toenail in the room. It got lost in a rug. I went to St. Louis, got in my room, found a toenail. It fit.
That's Miller. We'll be back. This is Ben Gillette, Mike Godot, Free FM, CBS. We'll be back after this. this is Penn Jillette here on Free FM, CBS FM.
Penn, the world's hippest audience you have. They're sending in pictures now of the Tigers.
Yeah, they got that stuff.
That's a good demo.
Well, you know, the other day we were talking on a Monkey Tuesday,
which I just found out.
Monkey Tuesday, and a guy called in with a story about his girlfriend being sick, going through a monkey park, and leaning out the window and vomiting on a monkey. So I say on the air, you know, that's probably a perversion we haven't got. Let's do a website for attractive women. You know, look for attractive women vomiting on a monkey and see if we can find anything, right? And we can find nothing. So apparently no one in the world is turned on by attractive women vomiting by a monkey. On a monkey. How long later was it? Like an hour later, yeah. A guy has photoshopped this perfect picture of a beautiful woman vomiting on a monkey. He put it all together, said, you know, the guys want it, they're going to get that. So Tiger Slayer to vomiting on a monkey, we have it all. Dennis Mill, I want to make this very clear because my wife's going to your show. I think she's going tonight or tomorrow night or something. You're playing at the MGM.
Yeah.
Which is a great, great theater,
yeah.
And you played there a zillion times through Monday.
I love your watch.
Through Monday. Oh, thanks. And then you're in Atlantic City at Caesars?
Yeah.
Next week?
Mm-hmm.
And that's also the weekend?
Yeah.
So go see Dennis Miller. I've done that. That's part of the job of you being on the radio.
That's nice.
Go see Dennis Miller. But you sell real well in these shows anyway.
Well, as you grow older, you realize you've got, talking about monkeys, you've got one monkey trick. And you better play to it, and at least the people know what my monkey trick is.
Yeah. And you also have an HBO special, don't you?
I shot one a while ago. They ran it. It's, you know, I guess they're in a 2 to 3 year cycle there. You know, you don't do them every year.
Mm-hmm.
And shot the last one around a year ago at the Comedy Festival. Listen, HBO, short of, I don't know what things meant much to you in show business, but I remember the first time Dana Carvey and I worked Vegas, and we saw our name on Caesars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, that blew my mind that we would drive down down that main drag and see your name up on Caesars Palace. And the first time Carson popped his head in the room when you're doing the Tonight Show and says, "Hey, kid, you better be funny tonight." And you're thinking, "Jesus, this is so surreal."
Yeah.
It's and then an HBO special. You get that first hour, and you know that's a big deal for a comic, man. That can change it.
Yeah, that was and they're still doing them. That's the great thing. You know, Carlin's
them a little harder now, which is even, I like that. I like the fact of show business is you could only kiss butt up to some point, and then you better be good or you're not going to get any further. You know, those lines of demarcation in show business some people find cruel. I've always found them to be, you know, liberating in a way. You don't have to be with the office suck up. You don't have to be vying for the same job. Mm-hmm. At some point, it's your talent.
Quality wins out.
Yeah,
quality
like
wins
that
out.
About it.
So it was the Tonight Show, Saturday Night Live, and your name.
I did
up
Monday
in
Night
Vegas.
Football.
Yeah, I don't know anything about sports.
Yeah.
Not a thing.
Well, some would say I did.
Listen, I've never even watched a game. All the way
I can
through.
Tell you is when I was 9 years old, I went to a football game, I think, and then I never went to another football game. I'd watch it on TV. And then I heard that they had an opening there, and I thought, well, I watch enough football. That might be a gas. I'll go audition. I like Al Michaels. I'll get to see Al again. We had met socially. So I put my name on the list, and I think they find it such a freak show that they're thinking, well, I'll give them a try. So you go out into North Hollywood into this big studio, and they put a game on in front of you, and it has no sound on it, and you just announce it with Al. So I'm sitting there with Al, and I'm thinking, well, listen, don't act like you know it. Just go for it. I remember thinking, trying to make Al laugh convulsively. That's all I remember thinking is try to rip him up. And so I started making him laugh, and pretty soon we're joking back and forth. I start calling him Albino. We form some bond, and I drive away, and I think, well, that went as well as it could, but it's not going to go any further than that. I get a call a couple weeks later. Ohlmeyer, God bless him, said, "You want to try this?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "You know, it's a hot seat. They're going to be empty." I said, I don't know about you. I don't care about hot seats. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It's all you can do is do it.
Well, it's not,
so they
not
tell you not to do it.
You kind of like it. I mean, you have to.
Yeah, but you know, to me, the highest rung of showbiz pain doesn't come near the lowest rung of real life pain. I can handle showbiz pain. You know, if you get whacked from it, you just go fine. Where's the? I've always had this lily pad approach to show business. I never see the far shore.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just looking to stay dry. I want to get to the next pad. If I take some departures, is on the way. It's fun.
So what was it like doing Monday Night Football? What's the situation?
Well, it's Circus Maximus. I mean, you forget how big that thing is. You pull up to that park at night, and it's the closest we have to the Romans and the Colosseum. Obviously, they're not feeding people to lions, but it's the American experience. And that part of it touched me. I mean, you get out there, you see a lot of parents with their kids. Now, these are feelings unfamiliar to you up until very recently, but now you know what I mean.
Exactly.
It's so intense to have some bonding thing with your kids, and you just see dads and sons and daughters out there, and it was that part of it was beautiful. The seat was very hot. I think the new guy is going to find that. You don't watch it, but there's a new guy doing that job now. And guess what? Half the country hates you, and half the country likes you. And very early in my career, I figured out that I was never going to be Jay Leno. They weren't all going to like me. And that if I stayed close to that 50 percentile, there was a niche career there. That was a pretty savvy thing to
150
do.
150 million people is not a niche.
But you know what I mean. Half of them probably hate me.
Yeah.
And I used to think, should I try to change that? And then I thought, no, just try to keep the poles in alignment. You know, you can almost hear the magnetics holding me in the middle of my
Well, where do you sit when you do Monday Night Football?
Well, you're usually at the 50-yard line. You have great seats. You're in a booth, and there's a bunch of guys around you whipping stats in front of you. I find it like being an air traffic controller, and I always thought of Al Michaels as the best air traffic controller. He was like that guy on the Ed Sullivan Show that had to keep six plates going. Yeah. You ever see that cat?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when I would watch Al deal with a commercial, the game, throwing it to me, all I could hear was, you remember the music that that guy used to do it to.
And do you have an earpiece in, too?
Yeah, you've got everything.
So they're talking to you, handing you stuff?
Yeah, and you just got to stay loose. Now, the most difficult time I ever had was not on Monday Night Football. I remember one time I was hosting the MTV Music Awards, and this was probably the last time I was officially considered hip enough to be in front of teenagers. It was my last year there, and they were giving a statue to the guys, the Soviet cosmonauts on the space station. They're up on the Mir. Mm-hmm. So I've got the director in one ear, and I've got the Russian guy in the other ear, and I've got this cuts out occasionally, and I'll get the translation from the Russian to American guy, and then the in-house feed is the actual astronauts talking. I'm on stage. I remember Eddie Van Halen was down front, and I looked down at Eddie. I got 4 minutes with these guys. We're just about to go on. I think there's a billion people watching the MTV. I'm not kidding. I think around the world are like a billion people watching. The director comes in this series there. Hey, the translator just kicked out. You'll have to vamp. I go on the air, I'm on for 4 minutes live in front of a billion people, and the Russian guy, I'd say, so how is it up there, you know? And then I had to do the old Sid Caesar translation thing, where he'd go, you know, and I'd say, I am pre-cirrhotic in the liver, I have to live in a state of suspended animation, or I will cease to exist, I must stay in space forever. And I looked down at Eddie, and I think it's the hardest I've ever seen a human being laugh, and it was that perfect mixture of, it's funny, but also, you poor SOB, I can't believe. So Monday Night Football seemed like a breeze after that. That was hard.
Well, I can't even do the CNN interviews and stuff with the guy in your ear talking to you. And there's the delay. You know, it's always the delay. So that's why when they ask a question like, are you in favor of all-out nuclear war with Canada? There's a pause as the guy thinks about it. He goes, no.
Like he's ruminating.
Yeah, sure.
He actually has the answer right there. He just hasn't heard it as quickly as you have.
That gave me the incredible amount of sympathy for those guys that are talking with a thing in their ears, people giving
them
notes.
Well, the misassumption is that TV always has to operate smoothly. And I don't know about you, but I think Barry Sand was the original executive producer of the Letterman Show, and he used to always call it found humor. And I always liked that theory that there's humor to be derived anything as long as you don't turn into a sweat act when it goes wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the problem, is you freaking out. If you just sit in it,
yeah,
they'll derive pleasure from your nonplussed attitude. That's
sure.
All.
And the telethon. I mean, I think that was always what Letterman held up. I mean, the real telethon, like when we used to watch it,
yeah,
when you had a man on drugs with no sleep,
right,
you know, desperate, just going for 24 hours, however long he used to do it.
Yeah, now that they're letting him sleep, I still send a donation, but I'm not watching it anymore. I know he's not going off the shoulder anymore.
I think that's your next project.
I used to love that when he'd sing Walk On at around 3:30. I think Bergman called it the hour of the wolf. When you have to confront your soul, and he would crack in the middle of the song. Todd Rundgren told me once that he had every telethon on tape. He would go over them like the Zapruder film.
But he must have that moment where Jerry talks to the drug dealers, which is my favorite moment.
Oh,
I saw in New York where Jerry says, it was in the late 80s, I was watching, and Jerry Lewis says at 3 a.m., he goes, "Now, drug dealers, I don't approve of what you do, but I know you've got money. Send it in to my kids." And he says, "I don't care what you deal." It is this whole list. Because,
well, that's,
you know,
what I admire about Jerry. I mean, I look at Jerry and I don't get it at all in certain ways, but $62 million again this year. You know what I mean? Yeah. He's still doing it. He's still, you know, to my way of thinking, uncomfortable sometimes, and other times I watch him, I find him intoxicating. All I know is this: Jerry Lewis has made a living for around six decades now acting in public like most of us act in the shower.
I was on an airplane with Jerry Lewis, and as you're landing, he does stuff like undoes his seatbelt, does it behind him, and says, "The seatbelt has to be done, but not over me," and then sticks a glass in his mouth and makes these noises. This is during landing.
That's how you want to check into eternity. You and Charlie Callis doing bad banter.
With a glass in your mouth and pushing your tongue back in.
I remember he had a... We got time for a second?
Sure.
Remember he had that talk show for like a week?
Yeah.
It was syndicated years ago,
yes.
And I have one of those on tape where Sinatra comes on.
Okay.
And he is called in such a marker on Sinatra, you can't believe it. Frank's just sitting there thinking, "Chili, can you wreck this guy and get me out of here?" It is so funny to watch.
Yeah, well, there's his introduction of Frank Sinatra is like, "Here's a man who took stardom and blasted it out beyond the stars and brought it back."
So over the top.
No idea what he's talking about.
Frank sits down with all his trouble in his history, and Jerry says, "You know, Frank, Vegas has not run smoothly since the mob split." And Sinatra looks at him like, "Can we not go here?" It's so hysterical.
And I'm laughing here with Dennis Miller. Let's just say again, you're at the...
That's okay. Don't tell you. It's just good to see you.
You don't have to say where you are.
The plug. I'm not coming here for plugs.
People are going, "I'm dying to see the show."
Listen, you've done enough plug.
Okay.
I want to have your company.
Okay, thank you so much. That's Dennis Miller. And the time that I allotted to say, "This is where Dennis Miller's playing," will now be used in saying, "Boy, it's good to see you again."
This is the longest
we've talked in 20 years or something.
I missed you. Sorry about that. Life takes you someplace.
Yeah, Dennis Miller. This is Ben Gillette with Mike Nadeau. We're on Free FM, CBS.